Welcome to Cognitive Rampage Podcast. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your cognitive rampage. So much going on in the cognitive cave for the last day in this cognitive cave studio. But a couple things to tell you about before I get to this guest. I almost got excited and just went right to the guest. But the second edition of the Cognitive Rampage will be out in a couple weeks in March. It's all finished and wrapped up. New cover, new theoretical additions, changes, took a lot of things out, but I've talked a lot about the new book, but it's finally coming out here in a couple weeks, the second edition, and the first edition is still available on Amazon now. After the second edition comes out, you will no longer be able to buy the first edition ever again, because we all will have grown. So rather than do two different books, I'm just replacing the first edition. So Dollar Mental Health Club is also on its way. It's almost out. DollarMentalHealthClub.com. I talk about it a lot as well, trying to change the paradigm of mental health. It's a fun road. It's a road full of changes. So it's a difficult one. And last but not least, I announced it yesterday on the Tribe of Change, but we are going on the road. We're going on the road to answer some questions about the top mental health diagnosis that exists. I want to get the research, the facts, the realities. So leaving April 10th on the first leg in 30 days, we're going to drive to Seattle. I just have my fifth wheel in a truck. We will be driving to universities, researchers, practitioners, asking the tough questions about the top diagnosis, addiction, PTSD, bipolar, depression, anxiety, and ADHD. So I just want to find out what they're teaching them. I want to find out what is the latest, what's working, what are the newest treatments, all this stuff, because there's so many questions out there. So we're going to hit the road and do 30 days, April 10th to May 10th to Seattle. Then the second leg, we're going from Seattle to Bangor, Maine, all the way to the north, and then from Bangor, Maine, back down to Florida. We're essentially going to circle the rim of the United States. It's going to be fun. I'm going to learn some things. We're going to do a lot of things, but my guest today is going to teach me a lot of things that I'm excited about. This guest comes to us by reference of Orlando Perez, who was also on the podcast not long ago. And I enjoyed that podcast thoroughly, especially because Orlando and I go back a long ways to a different life that both of us led. But Orlando Perez, following the ripple effect that like I like to do with the podcast, is follow people that say that people should be on this podcast. And I could walk you in with an intro, but you know what? I'd rather the man himself give you that intro. Welcome to the show, Dr. Aaron Turner. Good morning from Orlando, Florida on this side.
Thank you, and good afternoon from London.
I got it right then. Yesterday, when I was talking about you on the podcast, I said, I believe it's London where he's coming from. So
that's right. That's one of those beliefs that are right.
Well... Oh, man, already opening up with it. Man, Orlando was correct, because as I started reading over the last couple weeks before you were coming on the podcast, I could see now what Orlando meant when he's like, oh, yeah, you got to talk to this guy. You guys, you're on the same level here, but I'm just like, holy shit. So as I walked into the One Thought Project, and obviously that took me to the 3P organization and further back. But before I wanted to get on into all that, I actually like to, I want to kind of know about like the little Dr. Aaron Turner, right? Before you got older, kind of, I know it's not as important as a lot of people
assume. No. Yeah, sorry. Go ahead. I shouldn't let you finish.
No worries. It's just, I like to kind of develop the story to kind of say, okay, yeah. I see how you got to where you are from the epigenetic effect.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'll go way back and then you can rush me along whenever you feel like, okay, we can just press fast. So if I wanted to tell you the full story, it would have to start around 14 years old and, you know, early 80s. And, at that point, given what we're talking about, that's why I'm starting at this point. At that point, there was a moment in time, which I didn't really appreciate the importance of until later, where I had the thought, and it was an insecure thought, oh, I should probably figure out how I come across and how to be kind of respected and popular. And what happened, and when I had that thought, I didn't think, oh, that's funny. I thought, ooh, good point. And so for the next I don't know, 8 to 10 years, I went down a cognitive road of thinking about myself and trying to come across right, thinking about myself and trying to come across right. And the more I thought about it, the more uncomfortable and self-conscious I got. So by the time I hit 18, 19, 20, I'm socially anxious, don't really like groups, not very happy, thoroughly preoccupied, analytical, insecure, anxious. But if you stopped me and said, "Are you okay?" I would have said, "Yeah, why? Why do you ask? I'm just a normal person figuring out my life, trying to see what to do and deal with my issues." Right? So in my world, this was just life as normal. It was completely room temperature. And it wasn't until I came across the work that my aunt and uncle were doing in Lackawanna, Washington, you know, quite near to Seattle, where you're going. And they were looking at the three principles and basically showing that you're not experiencing the life outside of you. You're experiencing your own thought, which is creating a state of mind. And that state of mind is more or less grounded. It's more or less intelligent. It's more or less mentally healthy. So in a way, the fluidity of thought creates a fluid mental health that all of us live in. Bank on the insecure one and say, "I'm going to live this." Like, my mind was taking me through different mental health neighborhoods, and I passed through self-consciousness and insecurity and say, "Any houses here? I think I'm going to live here."
Well, oh, it's true, man. As you told the story, I kind of saw myself and almost a lot of people I've spoke to. You know, I even write in my book about the young kid, for instance, that has moved to a new school and he's coming through the lunch line. Before he's even in line, he's nervous. There's urgency looking around to fit in. And as the kid leaves the line, he looks, does anything identify? Looking for behavior, looking for clothing, you know, just that social acceptance. And at that very moment, if a table greets him with some sort of welcomeness, well, then he starts adapting what he believes right then and there, all the way to that table, you know, before he's getting there.
But what's interesting, Adam, is what I've learned that I'm trying to share with as many people as possible is it's easy to see the end result of that, the insecurity, the social politics, the lack of well-being, not being true to yourself, and all that. So that's all well identified. But what was life-changing to me was to see the genesis of it,
How did that
right?
happen? So when you're the insecure, you know, before you wake up, right? I love it with that wake up moment, that Genesis moment. Is, you know, to your story, you said working, you know, around your aunt and uncle. Was it a moment you remember? Was it this change?
There were several moments, but all of those moments add up to me seeing that what I was experiencing was just thought, was just more or less clear-minded, and was completely up for grabs as to how I related to it. So, did I walk through the neighborhood, or did I visit, or did I buy somewhere, or did I stop at the shop, grab a drink, and sit down on the curb? So, that part that yes, it's coming from thought, but it's not the thought's fault. And I'll show you how I saw that. So, the first thing that I saw was I was meeting with one of their people. So he said, "Why don't you meet with one of my people and talk with them?" And so the person sits down with me and says, "Well, you got anything you want to talk about?" I'm like, "No, not really. I mean, I'm pretty fine." And obviously, because of the way I presented, she says, "Well, what about anxiety?" I thought she was a genius. I'm like, "Whoa, she pulled that out the air." I'm so used to it, sitting there stewing in my own anxiety, that I didn't realize that, you know, anyone who wasn't distracted would see I was mildly anxious, or, you know. So anyway. So I said, "Well, yeah, it's funny you say that. There are times in my life where I get way more anxious than I'm comfortable with. Can you help with that?" And she says, "Well, yes and no. So I can help with it in the sense that I know where it comes from, but I can't help with it in the sense that it's a symptom of something else." I said, "Well, what do you mean?" She says, "Well, your problem is that you're willing to entertain mildly anxious thoughts. And it's kind of like leaving a lot of dry twigs around the forest. That you can't stop a forest fire, but you can stop leaving around dry twigs, and that'll cure it. And she says, you walk around thinking in a mildly anxious way, and I don't know why you do it, because it's not clear thought, it's not helpful thought. Now, the reason I did it between you and I, Adam, is I thought that when I saw problems, it meant I was particularly perceptive, and that I should take the opportunity to try to solve them when I could see them. What I didn't realize was when you're anxious, it means your mind is distorted by insecure thought in a way that makes everything look like a problem. So the first thing I learned was, oh, I'm treating a distorted state of consciousness as if it's a clear state of consciousness. And then I trust my ability to think through a basically destabilized mind. And as soon as I saw that, I flipped from habitually defaulting to anxious analysis to taking anxiety in stride as an inevitable but unreliable blip of mental clarity. So if I'd be at a cocktail party, before I understood that there were levels of clarity, I would get insecure and then try to get out of it, try to figure it out. What shall I say? And then try as hard as I might, it'd get worse and worse. Like I'd fall behind in the conversation and then think of something like, oh man, they're not talking about that anymore. Damn it. And I just thought, this is impossible. I'm just not made for this. And then when I realized it was just a distorted mind, I would be in a default well-being and enjoy myself, then start to feel insecure and have the same thoughts of, Aaron, you got to figure this out. And instead of saying, oh, good point, let me get to work, I'd be like, well, that doesn't make sense. And then it would drift over me, and I rediscovered the illusion of insecurity.
I talk about possibility. It's kind of what I'm hearing from you of like, it doesn't have to be a process that once we can have this awareness, this recognition, right? And now for you to help me understand too, to learn, is this a thought? Is this moment a belief change? Is it, that paradigm shift? Is there really this process of change as opposed to just a belief paradigm shift in a moment?
Yeah, my experience, Adam, and the way that I work with people is it looks to me that everybody has dysfunctional thought and everybody has purer, more healthy thought. But people don't know, firstly, that it is all just thought. They think there's some reality to it. So when they get in a distorted state, they think, oh man, I got to do something about my relationship, my job, myself, right? So they don't see the illusory nature of it. So then they're tangling with an illusion, which is self-perpetuating, right? Now, you can see that that is true. And if you see that that is true, it undermines your alternative beliefs. So I believed I was clear-minded when I was anxious. When I saw that anxiety was a feeling that indicated mental distortion, that belief disappeared. I mean, the validity of that belief, it was like, oh my God, how could I have had that so wrong? So there is no process. There's like being, not having enough understanding to see what's going on and therefore being victimized by your misinterpretations. And then all the implications of those misinterpretations, like trying to find a process, getting rid of it, doing something about it, figuring it out. And then
The toil,
that,
the
oh
toil.
yeah. Yeah, and that's not hard. That's impossible because you're in a misunderstanding trying to get out of it. And the only way to get out of it is to see what's actually going on.
True.
And that takes a moment. And then you're free because you're like, it's kind of like when you're looking at Google Maps and got it upside down. Nowhere you go is the right place. Well, there's no process for that. As soon as you realize, oh, damn it, I got it upside down, everything's good again. You're in the same place, in the same map. But you get it the right way up. And that's what we're working with is most people have their model of the mind upside down. So they're always reacting to things in a nonsensical way and going in the wrong direction and then saying, God, this is tough stuff.
Well, how do you know the navigation that bothers me sometimes when I try to talk to people about the separation of thought and feeling is this instance that we're almost trained, though, to move on our feelings. How do we feel mm-hmm. about this? How do we feel mm-hmm. about our past? You know, why? Well, I don't yes. feel like I like this room. You know, it yes. goes this far. This, yes. I mean, this okay. is a detrimental yeah. divide, maybe?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you the way I see it. You're right. And I'll tell you the way I see it, Ed. So to me, the reason the way people act on their feelings is so unhelpful is because they don't understand the information their feelings are giving them.
Mm.
They misinterpret it. So most people believe that their feelings are giving them information about things. I don't like this room. I don't like you. Or I don't like it when you talk like that. I like you the rest of the time. I don't like, sausages. I like ice cream. So, and if you really delve into it, you're like, well, yes, sometimes you like ice cream. Sometimes you're so distracted you don't even notice it when you're eating it. And sometimes you don't like it. And it's anyone who assumes their feeling is giving them information about anything other than their level of clarity will have dysfunctional behavior based on that because they're taking the wrong information from it. Now, from my perspective, your feelings are giving you information about the level of distortion in your thought.
One more time, please. Whew.
Your feelings are giving you the information of the level of distortion in your thoughts. So you know how when you get food, it tells you the ingredients. So if you want to know how close it's going to take you to diabetes, you just look at the ingredients. Well, yeah. The feelings are that way. That feelings tell you whether you're see, when people feel at ease, it's because their mind is unencumbered. And when your mind is unencumbered, you have this incredible intelligence that's way beyond what people are aware of, which is why they have mystical interpretations of intuition and knowing and all that, because the mind is way more powerful. But that power is distorted sometimes through certain kinds of thought refraction, right? But when it's distorted, that distortion has a feeling, and those feelings are unpleasant feelings. And that is vital information. It's valuable. If you're upset, you'd be glad you feel upset if you know it tells you that your mind is not on your side, because that's important information.
I mean,
and if you look at all the mistakes that people make, and I'll shut up right now, but if you look at all the mistakes people make, they all come from when people are in a feeling that tells them their mind's not trustworthy, but they don't realize it and they trust the untrustworthy mind. And there they go.
Oh, man. The good part is I can follow that. So the interpretation is what we're down to, the perception creation, right? So as someone is imagining their environment, what they're going through, what they're experiencing, down to every activating event, if you will, toward them, that perception comes to the level that the pertinent information is to know that the reality is what we're creating. What's driving it then? What's driving that thought to create the reality to remain true? Despite presented facts, right? There's some people you can present, here's the fact, and it's...
Yeah.
No, the perception of, you know, what's driving that?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, Adam, it doesn't work. I don't think it works that way. See, I think it works like a perceptual system. So as soon as you're alive, your system's brought to life by the energy of life. And I don't mean that in a like, ooey way. I mean that in like, look, you know, there's energy running through the system. We know that. Okay.
Yeah.
And perceptually, what that means is that energy is creating perceptual information, right? And when I say thought, I'm talking about thought is my way of talking about how the mind is creating perceptual information. And we know now scientifically that it's being done internally. So the brain does not know the difference between a perception and a memory. And we don't often know the difference between a dream and a reality. I mean, even though you're going to a degree you passed 10 years ago with no clothes on, you don't think, oh, I must be making this up. You think, oh, my God, this is not good.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And what that illustrates is it's not anyone's fault. But as soon as you have a thought, it makes itself visible through the sensory system. So it looks and feels real. Always. Nothing's driving that. That's just the way it works. Now, if you understand that, you stop thinking it's real just because it feels real, because you know, oh, that's just the way it works. Right? So what happens is every single perception is created neutral but feels real. And the person can take it to be real. That's an act of free will.
The choice, right? The act of free will and the choice to interpret. So first, it's understanding and being aware that perception is first being created by you. Two, then not trying to understand then further what's driving it, but yet accepting the process of what's occurring. I mean, yeah, okay. And then as that perception's created, knowing that what we can pull up the brakes if we want to, or hit the gas by the thoughts we create to determine what we allow to be reality, thus further.
Well, the way I see it, Adam, is it's more like when things feel real, how stuck do you get in the belief that they are real? So, for example, if somebody says something and I don't like it, and I have the perception, I don't like them, they're disrespectful, they were mean to me, right? I can say, yeah, that's for real, I'm gonna stick with that. Or I can say, well, when I'm thinking clearly, I'd be interested to see how I feel about them then. Right? Now, the more understanding you have that that's what the mind's doing, the more freedom you have about that, because you're not swayed by your emotional, perceptual illusion, right? But
That gets me routed. That, because that's the vastness of the mind of whatever we experience, man. I mean, that's superhero shit. You know what I mean? That's, I mean, that's how I describe it in my book. Is like, it's when you come to this idea that you go, holy shit, I'm creating the feeling, the thought, the image of it. I mean, it's sometimes people, I don't think, want to make it that simple, right? What's the avoidance there of not wanting something to be so simple?
I don't really know, because in my experience, and I've been working with people for over 17 years, they do want the benefits that come with seeing how simple it is, and they do want the freedom and the well-being and the perspective and the kind of relationships you're able to have when you see that. And they don't want all the suffering and the restriction and the victimization that they feel from not seeing that. So this is a funny one, Adam, because there's a way in which there's an innocence in the commitment to a misunderstanding that's like, if you really knew, you'd see it different. So I don't really take that so seriously. I mean, and I ask people about that, you know, like, well, why do you care how it works? You know, what's your invent? I mean, you were born like me. We didn't invent the system. We kind of just born into it. Like, what do you care how it works? Surely we'd all be more interested to explore it than basically be into getting it right.
Right.
You know? So I think it's just innocence, and maybe behind it is just, it's easy to be convinced by unhelpful thought that has a compulsive feeling that, you know, has your ear. Like, I think people start to trust contaminated thought in a way that, you know, kind of has their ear. You ever see that play Othello?
No, I mean, which
Well,
is rare because I
basically,
love plays, and I probably
yeah.
if go ahead, but no.
Well, the plot of it is you have this general who's a war hero, and then his captain wants to undermine him and take over. So he tells him lies about his wife. Now, the problem isn't that he tells him the lies. The problem is that the general believes him. And so he ends up killing a bunch of people and creating a huge mess based on bad information. And if you can't see what your feelings are telling you about your mind and how clear it is, that you're that tragedy, and we're all that way in some ways, you know.
Well, we hold on to it, right? Is, I mean, I speak about it, and I so do a bunch of other people about the narrative, right? It matches what story we're told, maybe, you know, what story we're telling with it, with our thoughts. So we just hold on to those beliefs, right? I mean, you talked about in the beginning now, like even the biology of it. It's like it feels real. I was there. It, you know, where does the fear come in? The fear and trauma, like experiencing something that is a perception change. I'm saying the tough things that people can experience this trauma and go, well, yes, maybe not. You know?
Yeah.
Again, it's holding on to something.
It is. Like years and years ago, Adam, I worked with a group of ex-military guys that had serious post-traumatic stress. And we had a really, over the course of 3 days, we had a really interesting conversation that started with them saying, look, we've been through some stuff and we have massively traumatic experiences that mean that we're broken and nobody understands that but us. And there's no hope for us except in each other's company. Mm. Right? And I basically said, well, I would like to introduce the idea that the mind is a formless potential for new experience. And any experience is just a thought in time, which has no substance. So you have as much potential for well-being in the face of these experiences as anybody else. And then they said to me,
oh man,
they said to me, well, that just shows that you don't understand what the hell we're up against. And you just discredited yourself in front of me, us. And so what do you know about trauma? And I said, well, I know about the way perception's created. So I know the limits of the system and the power of the system. So it wasn't very finesse, but we had this argument for a couple of days. And then on the afternoon of the second day, this was fascinating. One of the guys saw something outside of that narrative, if you want to call it that, that reality that they were coming from.
Yeah.
And he lightened up and he kind of woke up. And what was interesting is, because they'd all written me off as not knowing how, not knowing my own level of ignorance, which is of course possible. And they all crowded around him. And he explained it to them because they trusted him that he knew what he was talking about. And then they all popped. Now, one of the most interesting things that they said, and I can give extreme examples of that, is they said, we had traumatic experiences that we assumed indicated that we were psychologically broken in ways that we were not aware of. So every time we had the traumatic experience, it indicated to us how messed up we were, and that made us suffer. Since we've understood what you've said, Aaron, we still have the same traumatic experiences, but instead of being affected by the fear, which made us think that it was something really serious, we see a fear as a thought that we've had 1,000 times before. And every time we've had it, we're terrified while we're in it. We're fine beforehand and we're fine afterwards. So big deal. What difference does it make if you wake up every night in a cold sweat, you scream for 5 minutes and then you go back to sleep? I mean, it happens every night. It's interesting I hadn't gotten used to it. And it's all around that understanding of the essentially harmless, illusory nature of thought, even though it causes fear and suffering and terror, right? But that those are essentially emotional, perceptual, virtual experiences. And that the computer is the wellness and the, you know, the screensaver is the wellness and the clear mind and the default. And it doesn't matter what you type. Screensaver clicks in eventually.
Well, you talked in the beginning about, I love the connection. I think I actually asked you to repeat it, was we're limited to our own mind's misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. And I can see, I mean, these are the tough questions and tough things to say. You know, I would be in mm-hmm. addiction clinics and run tough.
Yeah, yeah.
They're hard. But I never quite really connected like the way you did there about our own misunderstanding. So whatever we know. So I love how what they knew was we experienced this, so we must be this.
Yes.
And this idea of broken, this idea of I must be ill because.
Right.
And then allowing that to self-fulfill, to create this prophecy of self. And but they only know what they know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And what's amazing about, I think, about the work I'm doing is based on three principles that were realized by a man called Sidney Banks. And he basically pointed to the nature of the mind, which is, and what he pointed to is the mind is unchangeable. It's a fundamental intelligence of life, a fundamental energy of life. In biology, you call it life force. In physics, you would call it that preformed energy before particles pop out, et cetera, et cetera. And that is because it's before the fact of anything, is uncorruptible. Now, what it turns into is corruptible. So you can have distorted thoughts, but it has no life of its own. See? But it feels like it does because as soon as you think it, it's running through your sensory system. So people don't say, oh, I'm thinking fearfully. They say something bad might happen. See? So they fall for the experience of it when they don't see the principles behind it. But that's the power, is everything solves once you consider the principle. And that's what happened with these guys. And also some victims of terror that we worked with. We worked with some peer counselors that worked with the victims of terror many decades ago, people that had been in bombings and, you know, stuff like that. And yeah, what was interesting, the counselors said to us, what the veterans said, they said, you give people false hope. And we're like, no, if the mind has the potential for new thought in every moment, and the essence of that mind is well-being and a free consciousness, then it's realistic hope. And we argued again for a couple of days, and then they came in, they said, oh my God, you're right. We've been colluding in a made-up limited reality that prevents our clients from finding their innate well-being.
Ooh, you're dropping bombs there, man. I mean, because, yeah, when you look at the diagnosis itself, it almost limits human potential of the mind. It limits the field of the mind's capability. So to then structure someone around any type of label in this argument would be to then constrict the mind's capability or consciousness of expansion.
Yes. Yeah, and I had that experience, Adam, before I understood this. Know how I said,
man, shit. I mean, you know, when you can allow that to really process in people's lives, man, and the again, superhero shit, man.
Yeah, no, really. But it's fascinating to me, given the power of the mind and the temporary made up nature of thought, that these huge potentials are both incredible but normal everyday things, both ways. You know, you can think yourself into a hole with no effort whatsoever, very easily, like there's a very thin line there, and you can pop right out of it with no effort whatsoever. But you need the understanding. I was going to say, just as an illustration, when I was more chronically anxious, before I understood it was me thinking and it wasn't helpful thought and all that, right? And that clarity was one thought away, I didn't need to try to figure it out. Happen on. I would have these moments where I'd lose concentration and I just pop into this incredible feeling of well-being and clarity and okayness and tremendous richness. And my misunderstanding was, God, this feels incredible. What a pity it's not realistic and it's definitely not responsible. And I would go back into my anxious thinking. Right? Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Sorry, I'm still out there in the well, that brings me to actually what I wanted to, what I wrote down earlier was the anxiety feeling, right? Because is the anxiety feeling, right? What we, you know, we see a lot of treatment today, if you will, a lot of talk about mindfulness practice and the idea of being in that present and not allowing the mind to go somewhere else but be there, and how anxiety itself, really, if you tell somebody with severe anxiety that it's self-created, it's the same idea of telling someone with post-traumatic stress disorder that, well, you really can see beyond that perception, that it becomes self-created.
Yes.
And I mean, that power, that's what I'm saying. When that awakening happens, that's why I still sat in that awe. I mean, when it hit me, I remember that moment where I went, wait, you telling, holy, it hits you and you kind of talk back and forth for a minute. Like, but
yeah.
Holy shit, I've been creating the entire thing myself based on what? Based on what construct of what is supposed to be of normal, of what to be limited by your limited by your own knowledge, limited by your own ability to change perception. I mean, you know, where does the ability begin with? You mentioned the 3P organization, so
yes.
Approach, sorry, that community. I love this idea, right? But here's a problem we face. It's too simple, right?
Well,
the world is too complicated, right? Yeah, I know I'm being devil's advocate.
No, go for it. Go for it.
The world is too complicated here. I mean, we've heard it with clients, right? It's too complicated. Yeah. It can't be something as simple. We're pattern people. We're always changing. So there's always new reasons why. The clouds of the details begin to paint that on that canvas.
Yes. Yeah. Well, to me, Adam, that's just the symptom of the misunderstanding that currently exists. That would be like going to someone way back in whatever time and saying, well, you can't say that the earth goes around the sun. That's too simple. I mean, surely we're the center of the universe. You're not going to get by that. And it's like, well, of course you are, because once people start to see the fact of it, everybody migrates in that direction. And whatever was a mistaken, complicating, painful, limiting assumption gets left in the dust. And then the next generation, people like, remember when people thought it was difficult to feel good? And remember when they used to go to therapists to talk about their distorted thinking? You know how many hours they did that for? And you know, the whole mental health profession was formed around talking about distorted thought and making it into a thing, and that was their idea of getting better. I mean, that will happen.
Holy shit. Oh, now that's a fucking rampage. Holy. Oh, you got me cracking up, man. I can see that. You can almost see the future selves looking back and saying that.
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking about making therapists obsolete here, because the idea. Does that. And what do they say in ethics class? Well, you need to counsel yourself out of the job. Okay.
Yeah, totally.
Here's a process to do so. I mean, in that belief change, man.
Totally. And the thing is, I don't mean this in a bad way, but therapy makes sense given the current misunderstanding. And it doesn't make sense given this new understanding, because if you know your own suffering is just thought can't hurt you, and you're as a result comfortable with it and have a healthy relationship to it, just what do you need a therapist for?
Oh, proceed, sir. You don't have to sell me popcorn. you're not selling me shit, man. I'm in. I'm with you. I'm on the front lines fighting that shit.
But it's not an attack. It's just like, when our understanding upgrades, we don't need things that were coping mechanisms for the limits of that level of understanding. Of course you don't need it. And we see that in everything. And that's where we're going.
Here's the question. Where does thought come from?
In my understanding, thought comes from the mind. It's out of the mind. And if you say, why do you have the thoughts you have when you have them? That's way above my pay grade. all I need to know is which ones.
It's above all of our pay grades there, man.
Yeah, exactly. So I just need to know what the useful ones are and what the unuseful ones are at my level.
Again, you're making it too simple here. So do you think there'll be a time perhaps when the future selves look back at us and go, remember when they didn't know where thoughts came from?
Yeah, maybe.
What's your, just throw it out there, hypothesis. We're sitting around smoking a joint, right? And the thought comes out of, you know, where does thought come from? Is the brain a receiver? And you're, this is just us hanging out.
In my world, just hanging out.
I love the preface.
Yeah, just hanging out. This is a disclaimer right there.
It is. Yeah, I'm with you.
The way I understand it is, and I saw this in a physics thing, but maybe it was a misunderstanding, that there's like this preformed, fertile, energetic field from which things are created. And in my understanding, the Big Bang was an example of that. And so is every particle that kind of goes in and out of, you know, that level at which they go in and out of existence. And I think thought is that, and I think we're all that. So I think like we are all the same potential for energy and existence in action. And I think that's why when you really are not preoccupied and you hang with someone, you get in touch with them because you are the same, and you are, and I think the way things look physically is a distraction from the fact that it's all the same fundamental potential for energy in a form. And there are lots and lots of symptoms for that. Like, you know, I'll be on the tube, for those who don't know, that's the underground or, you know, metro, whatever country you're in. And I'm kind of into clothes. So I'll be looking at someone's jeans. I'll be like, I like the way the pocket's done on that. And I'll kind of get into an obsession about it. And this person will be down the other end of the carriage, and regularly they pull their jumper over the part I'm looking at. Right? Now, in a normal physical explanation of the brain and the mind and reality, that shouldn't happen. If they can feel anybody's thinking, it'd be the person next to them.
Yeah.
Right? But I don't think it works that way. I think that we're all the same energy kind of in a form walking around, and that's why you can listen to people and hear more than what they're saying. And you can have a, like, I'll have clients and I'll think, you know, so-and-so needs me to call them. And I wasn't figuring it out. I wasn't worrying about it. And if it comes in that more neutral feeling, it's an example of that more universal mind. And you can feel what's happening for people.
Yeah, I mean, I've been there. I think we all maybe once in time have thought about a friend phone ring. You know, we go, exactly. They just emailed me, and we look, and the email's there.
Yeah.
I mean, as we do advance further, if we already joke about how they could look back and say, remember when they had to talk about distorted thoughts of what they didn't know and create perceptions before they realized they could do it in the moment, and you mix that with some sort of technology, man, I almost lost it. I'm like, and you could then shape true all perceptions of what is or isn't. I mean, the biological almost doesn't become important anymore, right?
Yeah.
It seems almost grounding.
Yeah. Well, I figure there's so much more to learn in that direction.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Well, here you can pass that back to us now, because we've had that conversation. There's, you know, anybody watching is like, shit, how high are they before they started talking? But they try to understand, this is every day in my head. You know, this is walking around, you know, realizing that, trying to wake people up, if you will, to that idea.
Yeah. But I tell you, sorry, Adam, go ahead.
No. If you had some, go ahead, man.
Well, I was going to say, it's funny that once you get into this kind of conversation, and I work primarily with businesses and business leaders and organizations, and, you know, because when people understand the mind better, what they do is less limited by all the distortions and restrictions, right? And those problems go away too. Like, remember when people didn't used to like their jobs? Remember when people used to hate each other at work? And remember all that.
Yeah.
But when you really get into the conversation, everybody's had those experiences, and those experiences have been the more interesting, meaningful ones. But because it's not the general understanding, it doesn't fit. So people are kind of embarrassed about it.
Man, even being embarrassed that we don't understand that we create our own perceptions that we don't want to understand due to the lack of what we are capable of understanding, and then living in the process of it to create our own narrative because we experienced it, and that's what it feels like.
Yeah.
Just to be right.
Yeah. There's a sentence right there.
Just to be right. I mean, when I think about that idea, so is it the idea of not overthinking, right? I want to kind of walk back through the three principles, really. Mm-hmm. And that first one of talking about the mind itself, we just kind of walk through all the vast capabilities of infinite upon infinities that the mind part can be. So the second part of that third principle, walk us through that. Walk me through that, really.
Well, tell me what you mean, Adam. I'm not quite with you.
Well, I was going back to the three principles themselves.
Yes,
the first,
I got
beginning,
you.
Meaning, mind, right. And then moving to the second principle.
Thought.
Right. To be honest, we went deep into thought, too, about what it is, where it comes from, I guess. So let's move to the third P, then. because I think we've, yeah, to the consciousness itself, and maybe, maybe a question about how does someone understand the unconscious versus the conscious or the conscious, and whether this is reality, whether this really even means anything.
Yeah. And this being what, where we are, you mean?
Well, I guess I'm pointing to the unconscious state, to where we have a belief that this unconscious state exists.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay. But does it really exist? And over our time, what have we discovered to know that this unconscious state really exists?
Yeah, we'll see. To me, and tell me if I'm going off on a tangent or not, because
I already did. So go ahead.
No, but if I'm not speaking to what you wanted to speak about, let me know. So to me, the model of conscious, unconscious is just based on a model of the mind that's obsessed with analytical cognition. You know, so if a lot of people's conception of thought is cognitive, conscious cognitive analysis. And if that's your model of the mind, then you start to notice, well, there's a lot going on that I'm not controlling that affects me, but doesn't occur as a cognition. And then you mystify that and you get frightened of it because it's in opposition to your analytical thinking. Right. Now, if you take the three principles and you say, look, the mind is an emergent intelligence behind our living system. Okay. And we experience that potential through moment to moment thought. And every moment to moment thought you have runs through your consciousness. So like electricity going through a light bulb creates heat and light, thought going through human consciousness creates perception, feeling, every aspect of awareness. Like you're aware of the quality of the thought going through your system. That's what consciousness means. And it explains we feel is real is actually only an experience of a temporary thought.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Oh man. Even the framework of the understanding of that there is a unconscious or a conscience is still yet just another framework of the construct of the limit of our own mind's understanding.
Totally. So holy every
shit,
thought that,
man.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
And just to illustrate that, Adam, every thought you have is conscious because whether you see the thought or not, you get the feeling. So right, so you wake up, you're a little bit antsy. That's your consciousness that you're having that kind of thought.
Shit.
And if you're not having the thought, you won't have the consciousness. Sorry.
No, I was pushing you on. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. And so then you get this, you start to realize that people are mystifying and demonizing thoughts. So they say, well, there could be a thought in there that's affecting you and you don't feel it. It's like, no, of course there can't. Because as soon as the thought is in play, you will feel it. Because that's the experience of it. And when you don't feel it, it's not in play. It's not lurking in the background waiting to jump out at you. You know, don't personify it, you know. And then you start to realize there are all these understandings of the mind that are essentially manifestations of misunderstanding and insecurity.
Right, but we experienced it, so it must be true, right?
Yeah, that's right. And then the more you believe in it, you experience it more. That's weird. How's that work?
So, I mean, in the analysis really is done by understanding the analysis needs no participation, that it will conclude regardless, and you're going to have the feeling, but really what we control is our reaction to that feeling. And through the analysis of the moment, all we really can control is how our behavior essentially responds to what that automatic thought would be.
Right, right. And your reaction to the feeling and your propensity to build on that state of mind, whatever level of distortion or clarity it is, comes down to your understanding of, oh, this is just thought, no matter what it feels like, no matter what it looks like, it is just thought. And it is a more or less useful manifestation of the power of mind.
Phew. That is, I like that. Yeah, I mean, that's part of that opening frame, but the resistance to it almost, right? The toil, I think, I speak sometimes a lot about toil, comes down to making a choice or a decision. and how much that people want to hold on to the toil, you know, hold on to that story, their narrative, because it maybe it defines them in some mm-hmm. certain way.
Mm-hmm.
The yes. trauma does, or the mm-hmm. you know, their history, or their present, their current. It's mm-hmm. it's too close of the definition of self.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But one of the interesting things that I've found, Adam, is it's not whether you think the thought or hold on to the thought. It's your willingness to see that it is just thought and there's nothing more to it. So when I've had people that want to hold on to something, who am I to say they should let go? So I'm like, okay, fine. So you should hold on to it. But can we see that you're holding on to a thought? And to the degree that you hold on to a thought, you're going to suffer. So if you want to hold on to that, let's not hold on to it and then complain about the suffering. Let's hold on to it and say, well, one of the implications of wanting to hold on to this is I suffer more than I would otherwise, but it's only thoughts, a big deal.
Oh, and that's not romantic, though. That's not romantic. We have to
can put some flowers in there. some chocolates, and, you know.
the self creation again. It's back to, you know, that narrative, right? The yeah. rationale of the understanding takes out the romance of what our own understanding allows us to paint in the picture or the movie of our life, really.
But it's fundamentally enabling to see a narrative is just a way of thinking. It's not true, and it leads to whatever it leads to based on the kind of thought it is. Mm. That's fundamentally enabling. And it's fundamentally true. And that's the part that matters. So someone says, well, you want me to give up my narrative? No, I don't. I just want you to see it is made up. And that because of the way it's made up, it leads to all of this that you're saying, my life always like this. Well, it's because.
Yeah.
And when you don't do that, which happens regularly, you're a completely different person with a completely different horizon and relationships and blah, blah, blah. And that's cool, too. So let's just get the perspective in there and you do whatever you want, but under that perspective, it's like, if you know movies are made up, you can watch any kind of movie and enjoy it and throw yourself into it, but it won't affect your dreams. But if you start to believe in the reality of that movie, you can get very freaked out. And the movie doesn't change.
Shit. Man. We are the director and the writer and the producers of our own movies, our own pain, our own anxiety, our own influences, our own bullshit. But it feels better to say it's a diagnosis and I need a pill, yeah. though. I mean, yeah. it seems that way, right? Yeah. But it holy, does. So much. Oh, you got to come back on the show as we go on tour.
Okay.
Love when to. We come on tour, and I'm broadcasting from somebody's research department about.
Oh, great. I would love to do that. That'd be awesome.
All right, we're going to pull in like a Trojan horse story here to where we're going to walk in. And, no, I wouldn't set anybody up like that. But will you come back on as we're circling around? Because I want to talk about what we discover, because I'm going to ask yeah, these questions.
I would love
to,
yeah.
Yeah, you'd come back
yeah,
on?
Yeah, I'd love to do that. I would. That'd be great.
Yeah.
I was thinking when you said about the tour, I was thinking, that's awesome. That'd be cool.
Well, welcome. Come on the tour, essentially, virtually from London. And then. Yeah. When we do afternoons, if I'm, I don't know, maybe before and afters when we sit with the experts in depression, the experts mm-hmm. in neuroscience, mm-hmm. et cetera,
yeah.
and brilliant. Really combat this back and kind of have an offset.
Great.
Yeah?
Yeah, it'd be great. Love to do that.
Beautiful.
Awesome. Yeah.
Well, thanks for coming on. I guess now we're going to be talking more while we're on tour.
Yeah, I really look forward to that. It's been so fun talking to you. It's really, really been enjoyable.
We're going to keep doing it more. Where can anybody find you? I know it's onethoughtproject.com. I posted that link and everything else.
Well, onethought.com is my website. Yeah. And there are links to everything from there. We had some trouble with our YouTube, so that should be up in the next week or so. The videos, a lot of our business-based videos aren't showing at the moment, but they will be, so check back in a week or so.
Yeah. Why? Question: why aren't you doing a podcast?
I guess I didn't think of it.
Well, you should do one, and I thought of it. I'm just saying, you definitely need to be doing a podcast, my friend.
Okay. Okay.
But seriously, so it's onethought.com. I keep saying the yeah. one project. That was kind of basically onethought.com. There, it was basically everything we're talking about here is what you're putting to play for businesses and people, individuals, communities.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm going to let just the speaking speak for itself on that one, man. But thanks again for coming on. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
And I'm thinking that I love you, so therefore it must be real.
Yeah, there you go. After, I love you too.
See you,
man. It's really fun. Nice to meet you.
You too, man. Bye.
Bye.